Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the science of tipping points and what they mean for our climate and our ecosystems on land and in water today. What causes these types of sudden changes? And how can society be better prepared for such events? Earlier this week, we spoke with three scientists whose studies involve tipping points, how they happen, and their effects. Peter Ward is a professor of paleontology and biology at the Earth and Space Sciences Department at the University of Washington. His books include Rare Earth, Why Complex Life is Uncommon in the Universe, Out of Thin Air, Dinosaurs, Birds, and Earth's Ancient Atmosphere, and Under a Green Sky, Global Warming, the Mass Extinctions of the Past, and What They Can Tell Us About Our Future. Simon Thrush is a professor of marine science and head of the Institute of Marine Science at the University of Auckland. His publications include Real World Biodiversity Ecosystem Functioning, A Seafloor Perspective, The Upscaling of Ecosystem Functions in a Heterogeneous World, and Altered Sea Ice Thickness and Permanence Affects Benthic Ecosystem Functioning in Coastal Antarctica. George Perry also joins us. He's a professor at the School of the Environment at the University of Auckland. His publications include Characterizing Wildfire Regimes in the United States, Positive Feedbacks to Fire-Driven Deforestation Following Human Colonization of the South Island of New Zealand, and Pyrodiversity is the Coupling of Biodiversity in Fire Regimes in Food Webs. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have you with us here. And we're talking about tipping points, this sudden change that can happen in land, in sea, in atmosphere. We have three experts on the field, and they look at it from different perspectives. Simon Thrush is with us. I thought we would start with you. You've been studying this, particularly with the oceans. How would you help us to understand what exactly happens in a tipping point?
Thank you, Maria. When a system undergoes a rapid change, the change may be readily apparent to a lot of people. We could think about an ocean with no fish in it, no shellfish on the seafloor, or something that people can see. Or sometimes the system can undergo a change which is more difficult to detect, because essentially these tipping point phenomena associated with change in the way the ecosystem functions. And we could lose function in the system, which we may not readily appreciate until some point further down the track, when all of a sudden we start to recognize the value in that function and we look for it, but we cannot find it. So in marine systems, we see tipping points that occur for many, many different reasons. They've been associated with climate and oceanographic, the movement of currents and the stability of water columns, those kinds of phenomena. They've been associated with the loss of predators out of the system, which is often due to overfishing. They've been associated with changes in the quality of habitats on the seafloor, which might be related to changes in the nature of the substrate, or they might be related to changes in the disturbance regime on the seafloor, how much storms disturb an area or how much different kind of predators come in and disturb the area. So the way the system changes will be very dependent on what we actually are able to see and understand at any one time. Those changes can occur relatively quickly over periods of months to years, but people also talk about very slow-burning tipping points, so changes which are occurring much more slowly. And that's often the result of you're interested in a process that is very slow to change. So people talk about that with coral reefs, for instance, in terms of some of the processes that are occurring, and the timescale of those processes is really slow, so that the change is relatively slow. So you need to step back a little bit further and look with a bit more distance before you actually can perceive those kind of things.
Peter Ward, what would you add?
Well, tipping points, especially the ones that we are most concerned with in my continent now, I'm in North America, really is climate. And climate getting to the points where we start seeing irreversible changes. So I guess a tipping point, as I've learned it, is really between two very stable states, and then you have a transition in between. And the $64 question, at least when it comes to climate, what might be tipping points that become, for instance, the most dangerous, the irreversible melting of the ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica? This is caused by heat, of course. But we've got so many factors that come in and out of it. And for a long time, we've been in a fairly stable system. we call it the ice ages, really. We're in an interglacial, so we have glacial and interglacial. But might we have already passed a tipping point where there will not be any further glacials? And so this, I think, is a very critical question because it deals with what I think is the single most dangerous possibility, which is rise in sea level covering over farmlands at low altitudes.
George Perry.
Thank you. I think for me, the interesting thing about tipping points is that, and I'll speak generally without regard to a specific system, is that it's quite natural to think that if we impose a little change on a system, so we change the inputs a little bit, then the outputs will change a little bit as well. And if we impose a big change on a system, then we'll see a big response in the outputs. And that's what we would call a linear world, and it's quite heartening and, I guess, psychologically comfortable to live in that. At the essence of tipping points is that depending on the current state of the system or the regime it's in, a little change in the inputs or the drivers could have a little response or it could have a massive response. And it's very difficult for us to be able to predict how close we are to that massive response. There's a lot of work going on trying to understand how fragile and or robust systems are to external change. And we're actually very good at it, but only once we've done it. So we're very good at diagnosing broken systems once they're broken, but we're not so good at diagnosing where we are relative to a tipping point before we've happened. And thinking about what Peter was discussing about glacial interglacial cycles, the big question is how close are we to that tipping point? How much further can we afford to pump carbon dioxide into the atmosphere? How much further can the albedo on the planetary surface change before we hit these tipping points? Perhaps 100 years ago, we were a long way away, so a little change didn't matter, but now we're believed to be so close, a little change is really crucial. So we're standing potentially on a cliff, we're walking towards it, but we don't know where it is.
You've actually done a book that deals with the spatial matters around these tipping points and what happens. And one of the things we were talking about before we started recording was about how once you have gone over the cliff, to use Simon's phrase, what happens?
That's right. So the book we wrote was really about understanding spatial systems using computer models or simulation models. And at the heart of understanding spatial systems is feedbacks. So that's, in a loose sense, the two sorts of feedbacks we look at are negative feedbacks, where the system responds to try and counter change, to damp it down. So an example of that is if you get cold, how your body responds by shivering, you put clothes on, you try to boost your core temperature back up and you stay in the metabolically comfortable temperature range. So that's an example of negative feedback. You're cold, your body responds in a certain way to make you warmer and you balance. Positive feedback is the opposite. It's sort of where you have runaway amplifying snowballing effects where a change in inputs results in a change in the outputs and that drives a bigger change in the inputs. So we get these runaway cycles. And thinking about body temperature, that's really what happens when you go into hypothermic shock. Your body loses its ability to control its core temperature. You get colder and colder and colder. You drift to a steady state called death, and that's that. So feedbacks are really fundamental to understanding tipping points. And the idea, thinking through the stable states that Peter talked about, is that strong positive feedbacks, reinforcing dynamics, hold us in these two stable states. And so once we fall off a cliff and we move into a different state, say Simon's sea without fish, or we move from a healthy kelp seaweed bed to a barren or a dead zone, then it might not be very easy to get back across the tipping point. Once we've broken the system, it can be very difficult to restore it to what it was. And that's a thing that is called hysteresis in the technical literature. And it's loosely articulated in these phrases around irreversible change, irrevocable change, difficult to reverse change. And again, that's counterintuitive, because it means systems aren't really symmetrical. Imposing one set of change on them will drive them to a new state, but it's not as simple as taking that change away to get them back to where they were.
Have you seen it in your studies?
Yeah, we've argued in a series of papers that most of lowland New Zealand, which was formerly forest, has gone through a series of tipping points involving a coupled network of processes that has got them to a point from which it's going to be very, very difficult to restore them, even if we take out the prime agents of change, which in this case were increased fire frequency. So we've gone from a country that was 90% forested to one that's 20% forested. And so restoring forest to dryland, lowland ecosystems is really, really difficult for a whole range of reasons. We've lost seed dispersal, we've lost soils, we've lost pollinators, all sorts of things that have happened that have stuck us in this hysteresis trap. And in the areas I work in, it's seen as the major challenge for restoration ecology. How, over broad scales, can we counter hysteresis? How do we fix degraded ecosystems.
Peter Ward, where have you seen it in your studies?
I've actually been looking at the fossil record a great deal. Some of the interesting aspects of climate can also be seen in the dynamics of ecosystems. I think this is being brought up. I mean, the beautiful example of the forests going from 80% to 20%, and how hard it is to take back. When we study extinctions and mass extinctions, which are very short periods when large numbers of species went extinct, we like to think, of course, the most famous is the asteroid coming down at the end of the Cretaceous, cleaning out maybe 70-80% of all species, and it happened fast. But the rest of the mass extinctions were different, and there is within extinction what we might think of as a tipping point, where you have what we call extinction debt, and some species were reduced in number. And finally, you get to some number where it can never come back. And that has gone into extinction. And the same thing with the mass extinctions. When enough species have disappeared one by one by one, you do turn into this irreversible system where your ecosystems themselves collapse. And so we can see this in biology. We certainly can see it in many kinds of climatology.
Are there specific regions of the world where we have seen this in biology that you can give us as examples?
Well, the ones that are scariest to me are dealing with the Permian mass extinction. This happened 252 million years ago. And I was recently with some very great modelers, a man named Dan Rothman from MIT and Sam Bowring. And some of these men are now believing, and women too. I mean, there's both men and women scientists working on this, but some are believing that the rate of carbon dioxide rise that took place at the Permian is not even as fast as what we're seeing in our atmosphere today. And in the Permian, all that carbon dioxide came from huge volcanic events, enormous paroxysms of lava spilling out on the Earth's surface. And it wasn't the lava that was killing off all the species. It was the greenhouse gases going into the atmosphere, causing extremely rapid temperature rise. So that's what biology hates the most, instability. Biology hates it when you suddenly cause a really significant, say, 5 to 10 degrees centigrade temperature rise over some decades or centuries, produce enormous instability. And that particular extinction may have caused 90% of all species to disappear. There was no asteroid. This was simply carbon dioxide really filling the atmosphere to a very significant percent, probably more than 1,000 parts per million, where we today are up to 400. So we're getting there.
What about in the ocean, Simon Thrush? You mentioned dead zones.
Yes. Yeah, so in the oceans, there have been reports of a lot of tipping points. They run from situations where we've effectively turned the whole coastal zone anaerobic without oxygen, so we've killed basically all the multicellular life in those systems. And we have large areas of coastlines around the world now that are in this state of essentially gone back in time to before multicellular organisms have evolved. Areas like the Gulf of Mexico, the Baltic Sea in Europe, and areas around the coast of Pakistan are major, major chunks of the seafloor the size of small European countries that every year either permanently in this anaerobic state or annually go into it, depending on the climate and the stability of the ocean in that area. So those systems are almost entirely a product of a combination of things. Humans are important because of the way we've put waste products from our activities on land into the ocean. But also it's about the nature of the system and the oceanography of the system that predisposes it to a level of stability that allows the lack of renewal of oxygen in the water close to the seafloor that causes this anaerobic state. They've been reported from many different regions, and often some regions that, you know, might be surprising because you wouldn't expect that those kind of conditions would exist. One of the important things about tipping points that I think George mentioned before is that often it's small changes that matter here. So it's not just one big phenomenon that is driving a rapid change, but it's the accumulation of small little changes that makes it much harder for us to understand. It makes it much harder for us to collect the data to demonstrate the facts of the matter. And it makes it much harder for us to respond to and implement change to respond to those kind of conditions. as well as those anaerobic events in the ocean, we certainly have a loss of major predators that have gone out of our oceans that have changed the way that those systems have worked. Those have occurred and been documented to occur in North America and Europe, around the coast of New Zealand and Australia. So there are major changes in those sense. We've seen changes associated with the movement of ocean currents. Again, this is climate related. And around the world, many important phenomena to coastal ecosystems occur because of the proximity to major ocean currents that are driving water around the planet. The proximity of one of those currents to the coastline can change quite a lot associated with climate change. And therefore, that can mean the supply of warm water or nutrient-rich cold water to a particular region will change, and therefore the whole productivity of that region will shift. So those things are all reasonably well understood, and they're reasonably well documented in the literature. Whether they're truly driven by tipping point phenomenon, which are part of this complex system dynamic that involves the feedbacks between processes and the connections between processes that work at small scale and large scale, or short and fast time scales, that's something that scientists are still debating. But certainly we can see lots of those phenomena, and when we try and fix those situations and try and restore those systems, then often we do encounter this process of it's a lot harder to recover than it is to lose.
So a couple of things that you said that were contributing to the tipping points. One, you mentioned overfishing, because when you take out the predators, then one species is allowed to really multiply, maybe to unsustainable levels. You also mentioned using the ocean as a big toilet or a big dumping ground.
So what happens is we lose oxygen from the seafloor, all of the large animals die. The large animals that live in the seafloor play a hugely important role in processing organic matter and processing nutrients that rain down from the productive surface waters. Their role in affecting those kinds of processes really dwarfs the physical processes that go on there, because those animals are really able to change the environment that they live in, and therefore they change the environment that the bacteria live in that are very important for transforming organic matter and nutrients. So if you get rid of all of those animals, then the capacity of that system to cope with a particular load of organic matter and nutrients decreases completely. And so now there's a lot of material which isn't being mobilized, it isn't being recycled efficiently, it isn't being processed through food webs, it's just laying on the seafloor, decomposing and rotting, and it's amplifying that anaerobic state, and it's helping to hold the system in that state.
You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about tipping points, the science of, the causes of, and their effects. Peter Ward, you also talked about the problems with the oceans, particularly because of climate change and the rise of the sea levels. How would you connect that to what Simon Thresh has been telling us?
Well, it's fascinating. And what Simon just touched upon is almost a positive feedback, if you will. When you start killing the animals and then they sit on the bottom and they start to rot using up what little oxygen is there, then there's less oxygen, more animals die, and this death begets death, really. One of the things I find so fascinating about this changeover, the two states are aerobic, oxygen-rich bottoms, and anaerobic, is that it isn't as if you're going down the percentage of oxygen step by step by step and things start gradually dying. It's you do get to a certain level and just a tiny decrease of that oxygen and you kill off lots of stuff. And it really is one of the best examples of tipping point. It isn't a gradual at all. You get lower and lower, and we can see this in some places like the Black Sea and other areas where you can have some marginal oxygen levels, just enough for some of the worms, for instance. And one of the other things that Simon said is also fascinating. If you have animals that are burrowing through sediments, they themselves allow that sediment to be what we call bioturbated. You kill the animals and you get a completely different type of sedimentation. But really what drives the world most importantly in terms of biology are, again, what Simon mentioned, the microbes. And these tipping points from oxygenic to anoxic oceans can change entirely the entire suite of microbes. And you can go from microbes that are happily churning away and destroying creatures to microbes that produce poisonous hydrogen sulfide. You get these low oxygen bottoms, you change over the entire bacterial communities, and then you're producing a toxin, a poison that continues to kill.
George Perry, let's bring you in. I remember one piece that you did dealt with an extinct penguin and an effect. Can you use that as an example to help us understand this?
This is work I did with Nick Rawlance and some paleoecologists and ancient genomics folk at the University of Otago. So really, this again is a paper about feedbacks and tipping points and the way that they structure ecological communities. And so as ecologists, perhaps classically, we were trained to think that systems have very strong competitive hierarchies. So if we look at three species, then we can predict that A will outcompete B and it should dominate that site, or C might be outcompete B. And so we can understand these hierarchies. And if we put two species together, we should be able to predict who will win. These are very long-standing classical theories in ecology. Recently, people have argued that actually priority effects are a very, very important and underappreciated component. And so, yes, there might be hierarchies, but it matters who gets there first. A might be better than B, but if B gets in early, then maybe it can hold off A, and so the system be held in a specific state. And what this work and other work that Nick and John Waters and co have done, looking at other marine megafauna in New Zealand, sea lions in particular, has shown that in New Zealand, before settlement, there was a penguin called the Waitaha penguin. It was very closely related to the yellow-eyed penguin, and in fact, we've only found out in the last decade that they were a different species through ancient DNA work. Māori arrived in New Zealand in the mid-13th century. They hunted this Waitaha penguin to extinction. It's the only documented human extinction of a penguin in the fossil record. And at that time, at the period that the Waitaha penguin went extinct, yellow-eyed penguins invaded from the sub-Antarctic islands and took over these marine systems. And that's important for us because the yellow-eyed penguin is critically endangered. It's seen as an iconic taxa in New Zealand conservation. It's famous for advertising cheese and all sorts of other things. But it's actually a recent invader, and it's been enabled by a strange combination of feedbacks involving extinction, depopulation of the area by early Māori, and so forth. And it's all driven by feedbacks. The first species, the Waitaha penguin, could dominate because it was there. There's strong feedback maintaining it. There were probably vagrants coming from the sub-Antarctic islands, but they were being hybridised out or not succeeding. But once we take out the Waitaha penguin, this other species can replace it. I think it's probably a bleak example of tipping points, but it reminds us about feedbacks.
So it's the shifting of an ecosystem, really, is what you're talking about, and the introduction of these other species that might, I think, in your own language, would normally be exotic or invasive.
Yeah. I mean, I think in more general sense, we're very worried about invasive species and tipping points. And so a lot of the work I do is on fire in New Zealand and in other parts of the world. And there's quite compelling evidence that invasive plants, key drivers of changes in fire regime, and can drive ecosystems rapidly through tipping points to completely different conditions.
And I imagine that the fire regime is enhanced as a result of other inputs such as climate change, heating up the earth, and therefore, at least from what I understand from the climate scientists, we're going to see more fires. And so that then, does it increase the chance of the tipping points in particular regions?
Yeah, so I mean, one of the best documented and probably most worrying examples of a forest and fire tipping point is the changes that are going on in tropical rainforests, and particularly in the Amazon basin and in Southeast Asia. And what we see in these systems is that as they're opened up for forestry and an extraction of timber resources, we see that the microclimatic conditions change in them. They become drier at the edges. Because humans are in the system, there's an increased ignition frequency. These dry forests burn, and they're not evolutionarily adapted to fire, really, and they're replaced by vegetation that's scrubby, more lianas and climbers in it, that's much more flammable. So we have a fire begets fire feedback there, where we have a fire that changes the system in such a way that it's more flammable the next time there's a fire that occurs. But the Amazon is such a large system that it actually affects the local climate. So taking out some of these large forest systems influences climate by doing things like putting particles in the atmosphere, smoke and ash, that inhibits the formation of clouds, that reduces rainfall, so we have a drier forest again, which drives more fire. And if we couple in potential global scale climatic drying, shifts in the El Nino Southern Oscillation, and those sorts of things, we end up in these very strong feedbacks where rapidly these rainforests disappear into a state where it's going to be extremely difficult to recover them, possibly looking at millennia. And interestingly, as with most tipping points, fixing them won't require ecological change, it'll require social and economic change, which is really underpins a lot of the recovery. We're looking at things that we can just restore by some sort of biological engineering or ecological scientific approach. Necessarily, they'll require a different way of thinking about the world, I suspect.
Yeah, I think we're going to get to that towards the end about where we need to go with all of this. Buff George Perry, you were talking a bit earlier about grasslands versus forests and how they have similarities, but once one shifts into the other.
Okay. So, I mean, one of the longest standing debates in biogeography, terrestrial biogeography, has really been why are there some areas that have got trees and why are there some areas that don't, despite the fact that they look as if they've got the same climates, the same soils, the same herbivores, the same disturbance regimes. And again, intuitively as ecologists, we'd like to think that if I told someone, okay, I'm standing somewhere on the world, the climate's this, the soils are this, there's this sort of animals here, they'll be able to say, okay, well, I think you're in a forest or I think you're in a grassland. But what we know is that actually the forest savanna or the forest grassland sits on a bit of a tipping point, and small changes in things like fire regimes, so if we have slightly more frequent fire, we can rapidly go from forest to grassland. Small changes in megaherbivore abundance. So the late Quaternary, the last 50,000 years, has basically seen the vast majority of the world's large animals disappear off the face of the earth. It's been a bad time to be anything bigger than about 100 kilos. And that's resulted in changes as the loss of biomass through herbivory shifts. And there's a lot of interest at the moment about whether flatulence by megafauna was a really important source of methane in the atmospheric cycle and how that might have changed climatic coupling, which is sort of interesting sitting in New Zealand because flatulence by cows and sheep is currently a major problem for climate change. And so we have this idea that we've talked about called alternate stable states. The same conditions, but a completely different ecological system, trees, not trees, and actually surprisingly easy to move from one to the other, but not always that easy to get back.
In other words, it's easy to go from forest to grassland, but not the reverse.
That's true, because it's sort of going from trees to grass can be quite quick, like one big fire. Regrowing a forest can take a very long period of time, made more difficult in this case because when we burn the trees, we tend to export soil nutrients out of the system.
And then, as I understand it, then that contributes to climate change, not just from the fire and the dryness, but also from the lack of trees storing carbon dioxide.
That's true. Yeah. So obviously having treeless or treed states has quite important implications for global biogeochemical cycling and that sort of thing. It's important to point out, though, that these treeless states are entirely natural. They occupy large parts of the world without any concern about tipping points or human effects on the system. And so the big grazing systems of the Serengeti and so forth are a nice example, probably of a reasonably natural, if I dare use the word, treeless state.
You're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and we're talking about the causes and effects of tipping points. When we come back, how can we be prepared for sudden changes in our ecosystems? Stay tuned.
The drumfish, they beach themselves in Harukari. The blackbirds, they fell in thousands from the sky. Their red wings, streaming down from the higher seas. Deflected by the ground, they crown the sun, they crown the sun.
You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about tipping points, the science of, the causes of, and their effects.
So George Perry brought up some interesting things related to extinction. Peter Ward, let's bring you back in first. I have been reading in the journals that the species extinction are up to 25,000 per year. Is that real?
I look at all those figures And I understand the sentiment, but I think we know so little about what actual biodiversity is that it's so difficult to put an absolute number on anything here. I mean, we don't know. Some people think we have 30 million species. Some people think we only have 2 million species. Increasingly, an awful lot of biologists are trying to look back, what is a species anyway? I mean, the whole definition is really with the way that we have lateral gene transfer, the way we have entire pieces of genomes being taken from one organism and plugged into another, that evolution and biology are much more labile than we think. But on the other hand, I'm also curious, and I'd love to have my other two colleagues think about this. We see the world today. We think this is the world as it's always been. Clearly, that's not the case. But I'm wondering if the ice ages themselves haven't produced an artificially high biodiversity from some of the same mechanisms that were just being discussed. There's alteration in the rainforest, say, from rainforest to dry forest or from forest to grassland, back and forth and back and forth. And the oscillations of the ice age were far more severe and far more rapid than the Pliocene, say, which came before it. So I'm wondering if we haven't driven up biodiversity to a very high level by this very oscillation, these return of tipping points back and forth that have increased diversity to a very high point. And we may be just falling back to the steady state before the ice ages.
What it also begs a question about is the importance of biodiversity and how much biodiversity we need in order to sustain ecosystems. And so before I hand it over to the gentleman in front of me, Peter Ward, I wonder if you could speak to biodiversity and its role.
Well, that's another great question, is what is the value of biodiversity? And you get some very uncomfortable questions like this, and sometimes the answers are uncomfortable as well. But it really does seem to be sure that, for instance, very diverse ecosystems in the tropics seem to have a resilience, that we've seen the coral reef community, you change the players. It's like a Shakespeare play. Since the Devonian period of 400 million years ago, we've had coral reefs of one type or another, and we substitute species. But these ecosystems keep coming back, and they're highly resilient. They are extremely diverse. They have many different species. We're reading now about coral diebacks in the Great Barrier Reef and many other places. But again, the resiliency of the reef system is such that you can't kill all the corals, and there'll be recolonization probably on century scales. So yes, biodiversity, diverse systems seem to have a value biologically in that they are inherently more stable. You have more species. Any single extinction doesn't drive them down. Whereas if you have an Arctic system with a very small number of species, you get rid of one key species. Perhaps if we killed off all the reindeer, for instance, we would have a very different set of animals surviving there.
George Perry.
I think the whole biodiversity issue is a very interesting one. There's no doubt that over time, biodiversity numbers, however you choose to measure that, usually would go for number of species, has changed, and probably there are more species on the planet at the moment than there have been over geological history. Certainly the 40 or so glacial interglacial cycles over the Quaternary have been very important for driving numbers of biodiversity, and there's long-standing debates about the role of that. I think in terms of thinking about extinction and tipping points, it's probably really crucial to realise that there are at least three types of extinction. So we have ultimate extinction, which is the species disappears off the face of the planet, and that's really what we've been talking about. But perhaps more alarming are functional extinction, which is where numbers are reduced, and Simon touched on this, to such a level that the functions that the taxa play in the system no longer operate. And a couple of examples of those, one from work by my PhD student Sandra Anderson and her colleagues Dave Kelly and Jenny Ladley, showed that in systems where we reduce pollinator numbers, in this case this is in New Zealand for birds, we can have the birds in the system, but the plants are getting such a low level of pollination service that they're effectively walking dead. They're not producing seeds, they're forced to self, so exchange pollen with themselves, they produce less fit offspring, and they will drift to extinction. The birds are still there in the system, they're just at such low numbers, they've been replaced by invasives in some cases, that they're not providing the function that they need to do. And to me, that's a much more alarming sort of extinction in a way, because we can go in the forest and we can see the plant, in this case something called Rhabdothamnus, we can perhaps see the birds, if we're lucky. We can actually see that the plants have flowers and they're growing, but actually they're drifting to extinction potentially. And so that's a very cryptic and difficult sort of feedback to get our handle on. In terms of a system that we might be worried about, and given probably one of the great challenges for humans in the face of what's happening over the 21st century is food security, pollination's crucial. I mean, we're dependent on crop pollination, and we know there are tipping points in pollinator abundance. And I don't think we can afford to be precious about whether these are native or exotic pollinators doing the services for us, but we know there are thresholds in pollinator abundance where crop pollination abruptly declines. The pollinators are still there. We haven't extirpated them. They've just disappeared. The third type of extinction, which is partly related to functional, is a thing called economic extinction. And that's simply where, and the case of the great whales in the 19th and 20th century, a case of this to some extent, where simply the effort involved in harvesting the animals is not worth it. You're getting almost less return than you have to spend to do them. And so that's another sort of extinction that economists are sort of interested in. And the work we've done on things like moa in New Zealand suggests, you know, economic extinction, in that case, the effort to find moa and hunt them, probably occurs quite a long time before ultimate extinction. But once you get to that point, the animals are going to either drift to extinction, or in the case of things like the North Sea cod, probably never recover to healthy sorts of stocks. Thinking through this sort of idea in ecology that biodiversity is positively correlated with stability, perhaps, but I think there's plenty of counters. Some of the most productive systems on the planet are in fact monospecific, things like mangrove forests. There are large areas of Central Africa that are in fact monospecific tropical forest and seem to have been around for very long periods of time. I think that argument has some theoretical support, but it's also been perhaps used as a counter to monocultural agricultural systems. And I think it is probably valuable in that context to realise a dependence on a very small number of crops probably isn't healthy in the long term.
Before we completely let you go and have Simon respond, there have been reports in the mainstream media and the traditional media and the newspapers about the animals in the wild within the next decade or two facing extinction. I assume they're talking about the large animals that you were mentioning earlier. Do you think that these newspaper accounts are just alarmist, or do you think we really are seeing mass extinction of the wild animals?
If I was wearing my geological paleontological hat, I would argue that we probably haven't quite entered what we would categorise strictly as a mass extinction event, but we're definitely on our way, and we should be very concerned about what we're doing to plants, which don't seem much. I mean, we're plant blind, effectively. You say plants and people sort of start talking about elephants, but there's an extinction spasm going on in the plants of the world, the insects of the world. Conservation biology suffers from an obsession with warm, furry animals, and there's huge areas of biodiversity that are simply uncatalogued. And at the moment, we're probably suffering from what we call the Linnaean debt. We're losing species faster than we're describing them. And so there's a paper a couple of years ago in Science about megafaunal extinction in the seas, and the description of marine fauna is about an order of, you know, several times lower than it is for terrestrial ecosystems. We know most about large vertebrates on land, and so that's where attention is focused. So I would be worried, and my main worry is that we're losing a lot more than we know, and we're losing a lot of things that we don't know, and that we will pay a debt for that, that the ultimate ecological functional impacts of this might not play out for decades or centuries into the future.
Simon Thrush.
I think those are really interesting issues that George has just raised. We started the conversation talking about how tipping points were related to function. And obviously, biodiversity contributes to function. But as George says, often it's one or two species that do most of the work in terms of delivering a particular kind of function. And often those are ones through the evolution of our species we focused on cultivating. But one of the ways that biodiversity becomes important is when we think about wanting to live on a planet that serves more than one function. Just as in our cities, we need to have more than one kind of factory, more than one kind of waste processing system, we might want to have more than one function being delivered out of any natural environment. And they could be related to issues associated with carbon and nutrient processing that I was talking about before. They could be related to issues of you just want to be able to take your kids to see a big predator in the ocean one day. And so that multifunctionality then becomes increasingly complicated to try and understand, because no longer is simply counting the species and forming species lists and ticking them off from place to place sufficient. And so that form of biodiversity isn't really all that helpful in any way other than a very coarse surrogate in helping us understand what the functionality is or the potential functionality is of a particular place. And to do that, we need to really understand what those organisms do. So while George is absolutely correct, we're not putting names on things so that we can't identify the diversity of life. Beyond that, we need to really understand what those organisms do and whether, in fact, there is opportunity for one species to replace another and deliver the same function or not. And those challenges require a different way of thinking about ecological science, a much more integrated way, a much more complex way of thinking about the network of interactions that go on between the chemical world, the physical world, and the biological world than we typically tend to focus on thinking about as researchers.
So this is actually relates to something I was going to talk to you about anyway, so I'm glad you said that. You had written a piece in, I think it was in Nature, about this needing to shift how we study this. What is currently being done in the study that integrates all of these systems and how they interact? Is there already an approach that is encompassing these?
There's a different way of thinking about change in the environment, I think, that we need to embrace both in terms of our research, but also in terms of the way that we manage the environment. To some extent, this has been encompassed by a process that's been called resilience thinking, which is really thinking about how you might maintain the capacity of a particular system that you like, as in it's delivering some functions that you want, in a state where it's likely to do that into the future. Resilience thinking has worked to some degree in some systems. It's been embraced, particularly in situations where there is less technology that can be invested in fixing a problem, and so the problems have to be solved by more ground-up processes. It's problematic in getting our current governance, Western governance structures, to embrace this idea, because it very much changes the way they think about how you might manage something. So we've talked a little bit about the potential for overfishing to occur in the ocean and it to lead to a tipping point. And these are documented phenomena. If you think about the way we manage fisheries, we tend to develop a model of the fish population. We make a prediction about how many fish you can take out of the ocean next year. We then allow the fishing community to take that number of fish. And we stick some precautionary fudge factors around that, just in case our model isn't quite right, in case people take a few more fish than we think they might take. But essentially, our model is that we believe the system is going to respond to a certain degree of change in the same way every year, and we continue to go taking those fish out of the ocean. If there are other things impacting those fish beyond what we understand and what we've incorporated in our model, then the way that fish population might behave could be totally different. Now, those impacts could be a loss of juvenile habitat associated with other fishing activities, such as seafloor disturbance. They could be a shift in an ocean current associated with climate change. Could be many, many kinds of things.
And if I could break in, this is Peter Ward. Just quickly, an aside to that, one of the fascinating things I've been working on the Indo-Pacific nautilus populations, and we take photographs, video down to about 1,000 meters. So we're looking at 100, 200, 400, 600 meter bottoms. One of the things the cod fishermen and scientists have found out is that when you reduce a fish population that was formed by just millions of individuals, and you reduce that by overfishing, you have a change from the fish being most worried about competition. Its biggest problem in life was that fish next to it and getting enough food. And it swaps over to predation. Now you're not one of millions, you're one of hundreds, and predation rates go up. And we've been seeing this in our nautilus populations in the Philippines, where they're fished heavily by the local people. Of the survivors, the rate of predation, which can be seen by shell breaks, is skyrocketing. And secondly, we're seeing changes in the genetic structure of these populations, where once again, they're not so worried about competition, but they're worried an awful lot more now about predation. So we are seeing the heavy fisheries radically changing not just the ecology, but the actual genetics of populations.
So actually changing the genetics of populations then affects what from there?
Well, you start seeing, especially when you have very small numbers, you get down to what are called bottleneck effects, and you start seeing radical changes in morphology in a lot of these things. One of the most fascinating fields of biology that we're seeing right now is called epigenetics. It's almost a neo-Lamarckism that when you have major environmental shifts, I mean really large-scale environmental shifts, organisms can start putting little methyl molecules on their DNA, and this methylation can turn genes on or turn it off. And in this way, you can produce radical morphological changes in really short time. One of the most interesting of all is the study in domestic chicken. Gallo Gallo appears to be one of the most rapidly evolving creatures on the planet, or at least the domesticated forms. Once we remove predation and once we remove the need to spend all day hunting for food, domestic chickens just took off in terms of morphology. This seems to be a pretty good model for the mass extinctions. When you've cleaned out the predators after mass extinction, you see this rapid proliferation of all kinds of new morphologies, because almost anything you build is going to work. But it might be a wholesale shift from Darwinian evolution during good times to this more Lamarckian epigenetic effects. And epigenetic change can happen 1,000 times faster than Darwinian. I mean, if you really want to change something fast, perturb the environment.
You're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and we're talking about the causes and effects of tipping points.
So then we go back to the question of where do we go from here? Like, what is important both scientifically, research-wise, but also what is important in terms of socioeconomic, political direction? And I think that was where you were going, I think, Simon Thrush, right?
Yeah, I was trying to get to the point of thinking around different models for the way that we think about managing the environment and using fisheries as an example of that. If we expect that we can be surprised by what happens in nature, and we can because we, as we all know, we don't know enough. And often surprise comes about because we are blindsided to different dimensions to a problem than we're actually focused on. Then we might need to be thinking about how you manage a system in a very different way from the way we currently do, where we think we have a very good ability to identify levels of limits on contaminants that we might choose to pour into the environment, or limits on the number of fish that we might choose to take out of the environment, or logs that we might take out of a forest, and so forth. So if we move into a mindset of let's expect surprise, then we might start thinking about how might we build insurance into the models that we have of how we structure our ecological systems, given that really, they're social ecological systems because there are multiple connections to people in these systems, both with us as predators or utilizing the resources in multiple different ways and impacting on the system in multiple different ways and multiple different scales, from going and digging some shellfish up in a beach to affecting global climate. And so we might start thinking about how we can create systems where we become less blindsided to problems by incorporating more diverse groups of people in decision-making processes. We might start thinking about how we do that in a way that the people are actually going to reach a decision rather quickly rather than shout each other for 10 years before they get to that point. And we might start thinking about those kind of social dimensions of that decision-making process and how that's going to affect our interaction with people. We might also thinking about having governance structures that sit around acknowledging uncertainty and thinking more about ways that they can build adaptive capacity in systems to cope with change, or is certainly true for many of our ecosystems. If we're thinking about restoring them, it's building capacity in the system to facilitate that restoration. So trying to overcome hysteresis, trying to create an environment where there are patches of indigenous biodiversity in the vicinity of a landscape so that they can provide stocks of recruits to rebuild populations and so forth. All of those kinds of things are, we play around with those kinds of approaches in what we do, but we don't bring front and center this idea that we must expect surprise. And I would argue that looking down the barrel of climate change, as Peter has been talking to us about, there's never been a time in human history, at least, and at a rate which really matters to humans and most of the species that currently live on the planet, where change is happening, where we really need to start thinking differently about those governance structures.
Peter Ward, where do we go from here?
Well, I guess we started talking about tipping points, and what strikes me is I'm wondering about the tipping point of public opinion. What is the tipping point where people start worrying about tipping points? It's interesting that, for instance, in the United States, one of the more rapid changes sociologically was towards gay marriage, and that from in a 10-year period, the majority of Americans opposed it, and now it is the majority are for it. I'm wondering if we really want our world to change, it takes people to change it, and to change them is going to require a great deal of information that is put out in a meaningful way. So how do we move towards a tipping point where there is acceptance by society that, yes, all this talk about climate change isn't just some liberal politics, but there's reality going on here. And in light of the recent election in America, which has many of us really crushed to a point that is very difficult to understand yet, this becomes ever more important. We need to figure out the tipping point where the majority of humans on this planet understand that we are a huge, large-footed creature stomping through planet Earth.
If you look at where the anti-science funding comes from, anti-science only when it doesn't benefit fossil fuel, that's going to be the problem with of people understanding tipping points.
Yes, true. But we also finally have gotten people to understand that smoking is dangerous. And there was a huge, the same lobby that the gasoline industry uses. That did take decades, however. That wasn't a short decade of change. That was 50 years of hard work. And again, none of these things are going to be fast. And yet, I mean, conversations like we're having today, I think if we could get more of these on social media, for instance, the more the better, I believe.
George Perry, where do we go from here?
Well, I think there's probably two broad areas of advance. The first is, to pick up on Simon's word surprise, there's a whole lot of technical work going on about can we predict surprises before they happen, which is perhaps means they're not a surprise. But nevertheless, there's a whole range of research going on about trying to interrogate ecological systems, social systems, look at some of their characteristics and understand whether we can work out how close we are to a tipping point or otherwise. So I think that's an interesting technical area. But I think ultimately, if we're worried about combating the deleterious effects of tipping points, then we need to pick up on the sorts of things that Peter and Simon talked about. And there's a lot of interest at the moment amongst ecologists drawing on psychological and sociological work and the idea of virtuous tipping points. And so there's a very interesting paper in Nature or Science, one or the other, a few months ago about social norms. And really, if we want to combat some of these changes, then we need to develop a better suite of social norms around the environment. And there's a lot of evidence that suggests that those are to do with tipping points. And so Peter talked about gay marriage, changes in smoking, those sorts of things. And there's a classic body of literature, which is basically about the diffusion of ideas and the diffusion of technology and the role of individual actors in sociological networks and driving change. And so there's a lot of work on agricultural technology, set aside landscapes, the use of hedgerows for biodiversity reservoirs, and how you just need a few people who are seen as successful by their peer network to take on those sorts of decisions, and it can propagate through the system. And I think that is going to be at the heart of developing adaptive capacity in a sort of resilience co-governance system. I can see how that will work for shared resources such as local fishery systems. I think it's going to be much more difficult to use that sort of approach for global things like the climate system. Sort of spreading social norms through the entire human population is going to be very difficult. And I think you would actually have to ask, is it something we want to do? Do we want, are there certain, you know, if everyone has this exactly the same norms, do we lose some level of cultural diversity and that sort of thing? And, you know, if you really buy the argument that diverse systems are more stable, do we really want to engineer a social system which is completely flat, where everyone has the same norms? Sort of thinking out loud. But I can see how this will work for local change. It's a bit more difficult to see how it'll work for global change. But I think that's probably where we need to focus. And that poses a problem for ecologists, really, because we historically, and I think to a large extent, still like working in places where there aren't people, where there's big trees, where there's big predators, where there's exciting animals, where the internet doesn't work very well, where you don't have to deal with your email. And it's beginning to change in the sorts of social ecological stuff or coupled human natural system science people are developing, the growth of things like urban ecology, people working in systems that are impacted directly and obviously by humans is important, but we probably also need to reach out a bit better to our colleagues in social sciences, the humanities and so forth, if we're going to understand the systems better, because a key problem scientifically is just about all the work on tipping points doesn't take process into account. It's what I'd call phenomenological. We see patterns and then we try and retrofit processes to them. But if we want to understand how these coupled systems work mechanistically, which we need to if we're going to predict them or forecast them, then we have to engage with a broader range of scientific sorts of stakeholders. If we want to drive the sorts of resilience changes Simon argued for, which I agree with, then we probably need to reach out to people who are expert in behavioural change, which is psychologists, sociologists and other forms of social scientists.
Burning final comment.
My only burning comment is I wish we could go on for another hour. I'm finding this fascinating. I'm learning a great deal. So thank you, colleagues.
Thank you. Thank you, Peter Ward. Thank you, George Perry. Thank you, Simon Thresh.
Thank you, Barry.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Cheers.
Peter Ward is a professor of paleontology and biology at the Earth and Space Sciences Department at the University of Washington. His books include Rare Earth, Why Complex Life is Uncommon in the Universe, Out of Thin Air, Dinosaurs, Birds, and Earth's Ancient Atmosphere, and Under a Green Sky, Global Warming, the Mass Extinctions of the Past, and What They Can Tell Us About Our Future. Simon Thresh is a professor of marine science and head of the Institute of Marine Science at the University of Auckland. His publications include Real World Biodiversity Ecosystem Functioning, A Seafloor Perspective, The Upscaling of Ecosystem Functions in a Heterogeneous World, and Altered Sea Ice Thickness and Permanence Affects Benthic Ecosystem Functioning in Coastal Antarctica. George Perry is a professor at the School of the Environment at the University of Auckland. His publications include Characterizing Wildfire Regimes in the United States, Positive Feedbacks to Fire-Driven Deforestation Following Human Colonization in the South Island of New Zealand, and Pyrodiversity is the Coupling of Biodiversity in Fire Regimes in Food Webs.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.